recording.
Now that we started, it's got to be like...
Okay.
Welcome to the...
First episode of Real Shit Podcast.
Let's start over. From the top. we can include that. I think that's charismatic.
Yeah, we're so charming. Yeah, anyways, welcome to the Real Shit Podcast. I'm Zach.
I'm Owen, and we're your two hosts for this podcast. We will just us two for today, but we will have other people on here
And we're planning on bringing many guests who will be future and up and coming filmmakers with different unique experiences and insights to give us.
Yeah, it's a lot of diverse perspectives, you know, that we have found. Do we want to explain a bit how this came to be, or just hop right into it?
Well, I think what we should do, so I'm going to introduce kind of myself a little bit more. So I have been making movies since I was in fifth grade and was recording in my backyard with my iPad. And right now my focus is writing and directing. I can do everything else, but I don't really love it as much. And so that's what I'm going to do for my foreseeable future.
Yeah, so I guess I'm up next. I have always loved creating stories. I've been a movie guy since a little bit later than Zach. I think I didn't really know what I wanted to do with my life, early middle school. But then later on during COVID, I found a fascination with just film and creating stories. And I've been into creating stories ever since then. I love writing. I love cinematography. I love all aspects of film. But directing is obviously my end goal. Yeah, so I want to encompass a lot of those ideas in this podcast and talk about it and talk about my just enjoyment of film. That's why we're here.
Yeah, so speaking about why we're here, for the structure of this podcast, if anyone's wondering, we're going to kind of go through a certain like sections of cinema. So every week we are going to talk about different little subsections or niches of film. So this week, for example, we're talking about Asian cinema. But with some future guests, we might talk about films that have focus on colors or films that use new industry trends. Like, we have a future guest lined up who does mainly virtual reality filmmaking. Yeah. So that's a really interesting perspective, and we can talk about some movies that involve more futuristic...
components.
Yeah, components. So we're going to go through three or four movies every episode. And kind of analyze them, compare them, talk about everything kind of around them, and then give our honest opinion on them.
Yeah.
And then we will give updates on what we're working on and what our guests are working on, and we'll let them kind of plug their brand, kind of, if anyone's interested in seeking out their work, that will be easily available to them.
No, absolutely. And, you know, a lot of these guests we're going to have on, you know, we know them personally, we... are involved with them, and it's just the perspective of young filmmakers and the industry. So, like I said, as Zach mentioned, three movies a week is probably the golden number. We'll stick to something around there. It might be different depending on what week, depending who we have on, and usually they will choose the movies and we will watch them. If we've already seen them, we'll rewatch them and we'll discuss them here in small segments. And also, as previously mentioned, we're doing Asian cinema today.
Right.
And so we chose three films from three different major Asian countries.
Korea, China, and Japan. Also from, debatably, the best directors from those countries, which we can also kind of argue over to see who we actually land on as the best director from each of these countries.
Yeah, talk about the strengths, weaknesses of
each one.
Yeah.
So we think discussions like this are important because everyone needs to learn. Like, coming up as a filmmaker, I thought podcasts like this and YouTube videos and a million other things actually helped me get into filmmaking. And I think, at least from my perspective, that's what we're hoping to bring to the table.
Yeah, basically same thing as what Zach said. You know, I just want to have, like, discussions like these can really generate a lot of curiosity into film as a whole. And just, it's a great way to express our passion for the medium. And I think that a lot of these movies as well. It gives us to experience new movies, and I'll use any excuse to do that.
Of course.
So, without further ado, do we want to introduce our three movies for today?
Yeah, so today we're going to be talking about Yojimbo, which is directed by Akira Kurosawa, director who comes from Japan and is debatably, but most
likely consider him to be
the best director to ever come out of Japan.
Mm-hmm. Some would even say he's the best director ever.
I'm
afraid we both are haven't seen his like 40 something movies.
Yes,
all 40.
But we've seen some.
We've indulged.
Definitely.
But Akira Kurosawa, visionary, and with Yojimbo, we're going to talk a lot about the situations that surround the whole samurai film genre and Yojimbo as a whole. The next movie on our list for today, number two, is going to be Fallen Angels, very famous film from a very famous Chinese director.
Wong Kar-wai.
Exactly. Wong Kar-wai, obviously, very unique visual style, very iconic visual style. Mm-hmm. He's known... Mm-hmm. No, go on. I was just saying.
My personal favorite director.
Of course. Gotta represent. But our last movie, shall you introduce?
It's a bit of... We're gonna have to spoil it just to talk about it. So once we get to that point, you might want to tune out if you haven't seen it. But we will be discussing Park Chan-wook's Old Boy, which I saw for the first time while I was here.
I got to witness his reaction.
And he got to witness
one of the more memorable moments of the last week.
And I've actually seen it twice in the past 2 weeks, I think.
Wow, right. It's a movie.
It's a fucking movie.
That's what I'll say.
That's for sure. So we're going to get into that. And of course, the debate in Korea is Park Chan-wook or Bong Joon-ho is the best director of
their respective country. Yeah. But without, let's jump right into the first one, shall we not?
Yojimbo was a bit of a three-part watcher. We watched the first half one night, then most of the second half the next night, and then the last 5 minutes, one more night after that.
Yeah.
And it is a beefy movie. There's a lot happens. Yeah. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, basically, a traveling samurai just comes across this town where two warring families are kind of butting heads, and it's really taking a toll on the townsfolk. Mm-hmm. And so he steps in and kind of plays off both sides to make his own wealth, but at the same time there's a lot of moral conflicts which stop him from almost keep him from his selfishness and force him to be a hero.
Yeah.
And if that story sounds similar to anyone who hasn't seen it, that might be because
you may have seen it before. It is basically the same story just in a different font called
It's a Sergio Leone spaghetti western starring Clint Eastwood called Fistful of Dollars. And we, going into the movie, neither Owen nor myself actually knew the kind of background behind Fistful of Dollars and Yojimbo. But apparently Sergio Leone, totally copied Akira Kurosawa.
Bar for bar.
And Fistful of Dollars is a bit of a bar-for-bar remake of Yojimbo, except done in the Western format.
Mm-hmm.
And we actually didn't know that going into it, so as we were watching it, Owen was like, Zach, I have something that I noticed, but I'm not going to tell you till the end because I might be wrong, or something along those lines. And then I was like, okay. I just kind of blew it off, because that's something that we do a lot when we watch movies together. Mm-hmm. It'll be like, we'll notice, like, man, at the end, like, oh, that scene was so sick where they did this and this and this with the camera. But later, like 10 minutes later, I was like, something happened. And I was like, okay, so this is just totally Fistful of Dollars. And Owen was like,
that's what I was going to tell him.
Yeah.
And I was like, and as we like watched it, we got kind of curious because we were like, this is like eerily similar.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd kind of figured that Yojimbo came out first because, well, one, it's black and white. But
Actually, not that far of a gap.
No. It was like 2 years or something like that.
Yeah, it was a shockingly small gap. Mm-hmm. And we educated ourselves on the whole situation surrounding it, which is pretty interesting.
It's fascinating, yeah.
But to talk about the actual contents of the movie, like I said, if you've seen Fistful of Dollars, you've seen Yojimbo in a different font.
Right.
They're very similar movies. Slight differences, but it's basically just one's a samurai movie, one's a spaghetti western.
Yeah, which is an interesting evolution because samurai movies came first, like before the spaghetti western trend, but without the Kurosawa mainly, but also Kobayashi samurai movies, mm-hmm. we probably wouldn't have gotten all the Good, the Bad, and the Uglies, the Once Upon a Time in the West that we saw in the future.
And yeah, and it's nothing new to see a Western movie that is just a complete bar-for-bar copy of a Japanese counterpart. Take The Miraculous Seven, for example, which is just...
Seven Samurai, but worse.
Yes, and that seems to be quite the consensus take.
Yeah, and we actually, doing some research, because when we were first confused, we looked on Letterboxd and we saw Kira Kurosawa got a writing credit on Fistful of Dollars. And also, we found a quote by Kurosawa where he said, "You made a fine movie. It just happened to be my movie."
Yeah.
Which he's not wrong.
He's absolutely not mm-hmm. wrong. We can attest to that fact.
Like, for sure. And we learned also he actually made more money off of the... Like, Kurosawa made more money off of the lawsuit against Fistful of Dollars than he actually did on the release of Yojimbo. Mm-hmm. Which is, again, fascinating.
Yes. With Yojimbo as a whole, I think it showcases one of the most interesting things about Akira Kurosawa, his love for the samurai genre. You know, when you think Absolutely. Of like these great directors, some of them you have like a style you can pin them to, like Wes Anderson.
Tarantino.
Action comedies, that's Tarantino. Mm-hmm. But samurai movies make up a vast majority of Kurosawa's filmmaking. Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Insane. And the amount of experience that he brings to Yojimbo, especially after making so many samurai movies, is perfect. Like the blocking, although some of the fight choreography for the time, you can kind of tell like nothing's actually being hit, but the blocking when there's not actually fighting going on is spectacular.
Yeah, and the shot design, as many of us pointed out while watching it, we watched this with our friend Blake.
He'll be coming on later, for sure.
He'll be on the podcast, don't worry, one of these days. Mm-hmm. Shout out to him if he's listening to this. But we were watching it, and we noticed so many cool things about the cinematography, the shot selection, mm-hmm. and just what he did with the camera. And there would be these times where we'd say, is this a one take? It had been like 20 seconds of one shot that just was continuous. And you're so immersed in the world, you don't even notice.
Yeah, and I think one of the more beneficial things about the time period is that they couldn't really afford, especially shooting on film, to mm-hmm. make so many cuts, so they could just hold on a shot for so long, but so they had to make it good. And I think that's something that really stands out in this film, because you don't actually need all these quick cuts, even though it's an action movie. You can just keep watching, and that immerses you so much more mm-hmm. fully.
Yeah, like if you think about how much shittier it would have been if it would for lack of a better word, to just have every slash just cut away to not show the violence. And instead, yes, it's clearly that it's like the impact isn't there between blades because, you know, it's 1962, I think, 1961.
Something like that.
They can't really portray those slashes to really connect with the body. But I think it makes it more immersive. Yes, you'll tell that some hits won't land, but it makes you involved in the story. And it's almost like you don't care. Like, it's watching, like, a stage play.
Yeah.
You know what's not going Absolutely. On. The stage isn't real, but you're still immersed.
Mm-hmm. And that immersion is just what makes this movie so great, outside of the story. Mm-hmm. I think the story, if there were any flaws with it, it's just that I'd seen it before in Fistful of Dollars.
Yeah.
Like, because I knew what was going to happen. It wasn't as impactful to me, but at the mm-hmm. same time, it's still a great story about a rugged samurai learning that something about himself and learning that he actually has the capacity to be a hero.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is something cool.
Yeah, no, exactly. And one of those things is that it's very much one of the pioneers of the whole anti-hero trope.
Absolutely.
Where it's, you know, you give yourself a main character, he's gritty, he seems self-serving,
but you know deep down that he's got moral values. He's got this
inherent. He can't help himself.
Exactly. And that's just one of the cool things that's pioneered. You see so many things take inspiration from Kurosawa. Star Wars takes inspiration from Kurosawa. A lot of inspiration from
Kurosawa. A lot of inspiration.
But this is one of his most iconic films. I think we can all agree that. And, you know, experiencing it for the first time, this was a really cool experience. Like I said, we really enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, I think one of the standout features to me that set it apart from Fistful of Dollars was there was one firearm in the film. Like, there was a pistol. And in Fistful of Dollars, it seems like everyone's almost on the same playing field. Everyone's got guns. Of course, Ramon, the antagonist, is like the best shooter in the West or something like that. And then Clint Eastwood outsmarts him. That's like the one unique part of Fistful of Dollars. Uh-huh. But in the same way, in Yojimbo, the main antagonist is the only person with a pistol. And that works so well as a plot device.
Yeah. Cause, and also, it also actually shocked us when we were watching it. Yeah, we didn't expect anyone to use a gun. And then you just see a guy, a samurai, pull out a revolver, mm-hmm. and
you're like,
power dynamic shifts
completely. Just like that. Like, he becomes a extremely imposing villain just because you didn't devalue his weapon.
Yeah.
Which I think was super important.
Exactly. It's just a very compelling story. And while, did this make me like Fistful of Dollars any less? Maybe I gave it a little less credit, but I still think it's a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do think Yojimbo is the superior movie because it did everything that Fistful did first. And I honestly think I preferred the samurai elements and how that shifted the power dynamic.
Absolutely. And I do think in most of Kurosawa's movies, and especially in Yojimbo, Toshirô Mifune is such a standout actor. Like, the best way I can describe him, and I guess Leone did a pretty good job, is he's the Japanese Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Like, he's so gritty and such an imposing figure that you really are, you feel why everyone in this movie is scared of him, even though, you know, he's the main character.
Yeah, it's just this kind of, like, for lack of a better term, the aura that he imposes. And, like, I don't mean that to sound, like, idiotic, but that's quite literally what it is, the atmosphere.
Yeah, his presence really, like, anytime he's in a scene, he starts off as the most powerful. Like, even though you have all these wealthier families that are like, all that, like I said, were vying for power, they're always going after him, trying to seek his employment. And that really shows you something. Like, everyone, he almost becomes a sort of MacGuffin in this movie, as all the characters want them on their side.
Yeah, because it's really well done. Like I said, they do the same thing in Fistful, but hey, they did it first. And with Yojimbo as a whole, the story structure and the way it plays out, this begrudging hero, and a lot of it just also, I think I found it really charming, a lot of the references to like the Japanese like mythos and stuff, stuff about ghosts that included. Very small segment of the movie, but it was nice. It was like,
it showed character, yeah, absolutely. Yes. And another little underrated and kind of almost unnoticed just because of the really epic and operatic stage that this movie is really set on is the comedy. Like, you definitely have comedic characters, and while you're watching it, you're like, okay, all this super dramatic stuff is happening, but at the same time, we get to see like this kind of foolish characters that are giving us something to kind of latch onto at the same time.
Yeah, and it's a lot of the subtle stuff as well. Some of the metaphors. We talked about this when watching it. We both pointed it out. There's a scene, slight spoilers, if anyone's watching, close your ears for about 10 seconds. But there's a scene where he's getting interrogated, and it's shown that his luck has run out. They show that the sake bottle is out.
Empty, yeah.
Yeah.
So he's pouring himself sake, and right at the moment that we realize, okay, the Pokemon has figured out what our main character is onto, the sake runs out just like his luck did, which we just thought was such a clever touch. And there's also just so much going on in every scene. Like, in that scene, we have a letter on the table that could totally expose the main character, and he tries to cover it up with the bottle very subtly, or like fling it to the side. And it's just the suspense in every scene. It's like the old Hitchcock bomb under the table.
Yeah.
Kurosawa never fails to make each scene
It is endearing and intense, yes. it's just this way that he like captures this. And another thing that just I was thinking of while Zach was talking, the set design as a whole allows
fantastic
such amazing stuff.
There's a shot where as both the two families are coming together, Toshiro Mifune's character is sitting like atop like a perch. And it's just so random. He's like atop of a little mini tower. Mm-hmm. Yes. And he's just sitting down, crisscross applesauce, just ready to watch them fight.
Yeah.
Who thinks of that? Who thinks when they're doing production design, let's throw this tower in there so that he can just, you know, do
yeah
that.
Let's just, like, that's the only purpose of the tower. And it's so cool. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you got the phenomenal shot where it's just of Toshiro Mifune's character alone with this huge amount of smoke and fog
absolutely
surrounding him. And it just, for black and white films, you don't get the
atmosphere
of like colors of like powerful reds striking your character, some impactful, sorrowful blues. You gotta use what you can. And that smoke and just the fog in the movie is so well utilized. Mm.
And one of the settings, I believe it's the innkeeper's like home, mm-hmm. he has like blinds or some sort of wall that like goes up and goes down, so you mm-hmm. can like we can reveal something and then hide it right away, and that was just extremely cool and a great way to visually tell the story.
Mm-hmm. A lot of this film uses a really which, you know, in movies nowadays it always seems to be shallow depth of field,
yes,
where everything, the background always out of focus and then the foreground heavily in focus.
Which is an interesting trend because people think it makes things more dramatic, but at the same time, Yojimbo proves it differently.
Yeah, Yojimbo has this really just long depth of field where you can see pretty much everything that's
everything
in
the
camera.
It's a super telephoto.
And it's really interesting because you'll see things in the background. Each shot is very dynamic. It'll have movement in the background, movement in the foreground, and then just everything moving around. Very, for lack of a better word, Citizen Kane-esque. To compare it to another film, Citizen Kane, really good with just depth. Another movie I watched recently, which I should have watched a while back.
Well, yeah, so that's Yojimbo.
That's Yojimbo. Now, do we want to talk about Kurosawa?
We should talk about Kurosawa as a whole, especially. So when I believe Kurosawa, it might be one of the three best directors of all time.
I would say he absolutely deserves a spot in the just in the GOAT conversation of directors.
And I think what you need to get into that almost category, that caliber, is you have to have made one of the best films of all time, and then the rest of your filmography has to be exceptional. Mm-hmm. And Kurosawa, at least from what I've seen, and I've seen four or five of his films so far, and I'm planning on seeing many more, has never missed.
No.
I gotta sneeze.
Oh, okay. I'll take over. But, yeah, when you think of like some of the greatest directors of all time, you think of a few things like range, ability to create consistent quality. Mm-hmm. And Kurosawa, we have yet to experience the true grasp of range. I have yet to see like Ran.
We want
to
see Ikiru too.
Ikiru, I've heard
great
phenomenal things
about.
Which it might be in an upcoming episode. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So will Ran.
Stay tuned. But with Yojimbo, it was a classic samurai story. But he just executed it so well.
So well.
And I won't act like there aren't other phenomenal directors. Japan is one of the powerhouses of film.
Absolutely. In both animation and live action.
Yes, absolutely. It is debatably the best country in animation.
I mean, during the 90s, that was pretty clearly
the case.
Disney. Oh. But now, I think, Japan has solidified its spot through Miyazaki and every other animated...
Anyways, like what we were saying.
One sec. Just you.
Back to Kurosawa, sorry. We probably just cut out for a second there.
Yeah, so what were we saying?
We were talking about Kurosawa and like animation as a whole.
Right. So Japan, especially with Studio Ghibli, like fantastic. Like some of my favorite movies have come out of Miyazaki's work.
Yeah.
Like, it's undeniable, they're some of the best country for animation.
Oh, no doubt in my mind. It's, I think, obviously, you know, the U.S., you know, we're in pretty much every stage of film, we're the dominant country, but if you look at foreign powerhouses, Japan, it rivals us pretty fucking well for animation. Like,
there's not many countries that do animation and have such a specific type style, absolutely. Like Japan does.
So it's for Kurosawa to be the best, debatably the best director from Japan, or filmmaker really at all from Japan, is insanity. And he has made, we both think Seven Samurai, we both consider it a perfect movie.
Absolutely.
And we think it's probably one of the, not even, it's been both of our, like if we're talking best movies as opposed to favorites, I think it's in both of our top five all time, honestly.
It's absolutely phenomenal. Yeah.
And like me personally, I even think Rashomon, which is better, at least from a storytelling perspective. And that's crazy to be able to make a perfect movie and then make another movie that can be seen as better.
Yeah, that's
insane. So Kurosawa is probably the GOAT. Now, every time we talk about Kurosawa, Owen does make a good point, and he brings up a different Japanese director who I'm actually yet to see any of his work.
He's slightly less well-known, but you've probably heard of a few of his movies if you don't recognize the name.
And that is, of course,
The director's name is, of course, I'm not blanking on it right now.
Oh, my God, Owen. It starts with the K?
Starts with a K.
And ends in an Obayashi?
Oh, yeah. Masako Kobayashi. Which, sorry for blanking on it just there, but yes, he's a fucking phenomenal director. He's a damn fine director. I've seen Harakiri and The Human Condition Part 1, yet to see Parts 2 and 3. Maybe we'll do an episode on that trilogy.
Absolutely.
A calm 9-hour viewing. But no, it is. If we have enough free time, we'll run that one week. But I love both of those movies. They were phenomenal. Some of the best ones I've ever seen. But even I will admit, Kobayashi, no matter how many movies he's made that are phenomenal, Kurosawa just has so many well-revered movies.
Yeah.
And with Yojimbo, he just adds to that catalog in my mind.
And honestly, I think a lot of times people talk about quantity over quality. I think Kurosawa has the highest caliber film out of either out of the two of them. Or Miyazaki, if he's your third. I think Seven Samurai is still better than Spirited Away or the Human Condition trilogy. And he also has more.
Yeah.
So he is better in both regards, and so I think that's why both of us would regard Kurosawa as the greatest filmmaker from Japan.
And like I said, all of this can be subject to opinionation, you
know? Of course,
and
it's all subjective.
We haven't seen the full Human Condition trilogy, and obviously there's other films we haven't seen from Kurosawa that might lower our opinion of him, but hopefully I think that would be difficult.
Yeah.
Especially with how highly I think he's regarded. Seven Samurai is one of my favorite films of all time, and I think he's just a genius, and like I said, Yojimbo for this to prove it. And one thing I wanted to ask you, Zach, this is a decision-making live on the podcast. But I was going to say, do we do a little ranking? Do we do a little, not ranking, rating? Do we give each movie a out of 10 rating?
I think we should.
Yeah. We're not going to do like out of 100, give you every single decimal point, but we'll give you a rating out of 10.
My Letterboxd Yojimbo rating is a 4-star. And I think that reflects pretty well. Like, I think 4 out of 5, to be clear. But on a scale of 10, I think it's probably around an 8 for me.
Yeah, I would say an 8 out of 10 as well. I think this was an 8 out of 10 in my books. I know some people are like, 8 out of 10 is solid, 9 out of 10 is good. 8 out of 10 is great for me. That is
absolutely
a banger movie. Like, it's going to stick with me for a while. And then 9s and 10s, I reserve those for the tops.
Absolutely. So 8 out of 10, still amazing storytelling, amazing filmmaking.
We think
Yojimbo is, again, and you watch good movies, you watch bad movies, Yojimbo is a great movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So. And now we spent around, I think, 30 minutes introducing you guys to Yojimbo and our concept. Let's move to a different side of the little Pacific channel between them. Let's move over to China and talk about our
fallen
good
angels.
Friend, Wong Kar-wai. Yeah, and his a fallen angel. So, for a brief little introduction to our history with Wong Kar-wai, this guy, Zach, it's his personal favorite director. And
he's my favorite director, and I've seen 3 of his movies at this point, so that might be jumping to conclusions. But he has made both the best movie I've ever seen and the movie I consider my favorite. and that's In the Mood for Love. I think it is, we talked about Seven Samurai being a perfect movie. I think In the Mood for Love, at least me watching it, it's also perfect. I think it's in the top tier out of movies ever, and I think it hasn't gotten the exposure it deserves, but coming from China, that makes sense that American audiences might not have seen it as much, especially since Wong Kar-wai's style is kind of divisive across his other movies. I think it's, there's a lot less messing around with shutter speed and wide angle lenses in The Mood for Love, and I think that's what makes it so appealing to me, because it's a way to show your style without having to overdo it. And it's just such a beautiful, it's an emotional experience for me, and it's also just perfect. It's filmmaking at its finest, and so that's why when I saw it, I knew this was going to be one of my favorite movies. And then I watched it again and again, and I knew it was my favorite movie. And just by making my favorite movie, and also making Chungking Express, which I think is, again, it's really damn good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that just solidified Wong Kar-wai at the top for me.
Yeah. Chungking Express, it was my only experience coming into Fallen Angels. But obviously, I had heard of In the Mood for Love, and I had heard Zach's praises for it.
My glazes.
Yeah, you could say. But obviously, I knew his reputation. His reputation precedes him. And Fallen Angels, I had heard a lot about. It's a lot of people's favorite movie. On like those, I hate to snap back to reality, on those TikTok lists, those top tens, you know. Fallen Angels is a common pick, and I had heard great things about it. Like I said, I watched Chungking. I personally really liked it. My only really big flaw with it was that I can never listen to
that one song that we're not going to sing a lyric from or like comment, because then it's going to get stuck in our heads.
Yes.
Because it's played so much. But the song that happens in the second half of the movie,
you'll know if you watch it. We're not going to say the song, because you won't ever want to listen to it again after watching the movie. Absolutely,
but
you'll be sick of it.
Yeah, but Chungking, we'll probably talk about Wong Kar-wai in a later episode. The first half of Chungking to me is perfect in every way, but then I think the second half is written perfectly. It's just executed in a less perfect way.
I would have to agree, yeah.
Which might also play into how we view Fallen Angels.
Yeah, so let's talk about our viewing of Fallen Angels. We split this into two chunks. We watched the first half one night, and then honestly, it was
about a week.
Yeah, it was about a week separation, and then we finished the movie. But we're used to splitting up movies like that. Don't worry, we didn't lose track of the plot. Right. We kept track of it pretty well.
But the problem is it's not the easiest plot to keep track of, and I think that comes with the fact that you're jumping perspectives from character to character to character throughout the whole movie. Like, we have at least four characters that we've seen the viewpoint of, and I think that gets a little confusing.
Yeah, no, most definitely. It's honestly, it gets a little just hectic with how much this movie just can change perspectives. And it's not like we're not used to this from Wong Kar-wai. Like I said, Chungking does this as well.
Right.
But I felt like in Chungking, it was a little more legible.
Yeah.
It was more comprehensible, and in Fallen Angels, they really make you work to keep track of the story.
Absolutely. And it's a bit of a, same with the second half of Chungking, it's a bit of a perverted story in some parts.
Yes.
Like, there's definitely some weirdness. It's almost like the little Tarantino feet thing. There's a little bit of stalkery or kind of creepy activities that happen throughout the movie, and it's just, Wong Kar-wai doesn't always show them. Like, there was one scene at the end we were confused about what actually happened, where the mute character, who, by the way, we had no idea he was mute until reading a review of it. But the mute character, so not the hitman or the prostitute, but the other one, was chopping a man's fingers off for saying he wanted an hour before he could get a haircut or something along those lines, and it was, they didn't show it. We just heard screaming, and it was kind of confusing, and we didn't exactly know what was happening. And I think another thing that takes away from the clarity of the movie is all the style, all the slow shutter, and the colors, and just the vibrance, and the wide-angle lens, and all of that really just kind of with the story as disjointed as this mm-hmm. one, it's almost like Pulp Fiction where you have so many plot lines. But Pulp Fiction at least is we're seeing everything pretty clearly. In Fallen Angels, everything is told in a super artistic way. That makes it a little bit more difficult to follow.
Yeah, no, most definitely. A lot of what Zach says, I feel the same way. We watched it and we had pretty similar end opinions. There are going to be movies, obviously, where our opinions differ heavily.
Absolutely.
But for these ones, we, at least with Fallen Angels in particular, they lined up pretty damn well. Mm-hmm. Like I said, the film from a filmmaking perspective,
phenomenal.
Oh my goodness. Wong Kar-wai is an incredible director. He made this movie just look so fun. It is so experimental. There were so many things where a lot of directors just don't have the gall to perform some of the things he did. The shutter speed gets messed around with a lot.
There's some random shots in black and white.
Yeah, and then even within the shots in black and white, there was a shot in black and white where the shower curtain was in color.
Yeah.
Why was the shower curtain in color? We still haven't figured it out.
And that's where our problem
That's where the problems come in, though.
Because we kind of get the story, and we get parts of the artistic style, mm-hmm. but we don't get how one benefits the other.
Yes. And there are times where we'll just say, well, why did that happen?
Yeah.
Why did this happen?
Yeah, like, why do we care that the shower curtain's in color?
Obviously, this isn't anything new to have a black and white scene with one thing in color. Like, Schindler's List does it with the jacket.
All the time.
And it's just like, those things, they make sense. Those aren't motifs that are hard to figure out. But the shower curtain, that spun us for a loop when we were watching it. We just kind of stopped and we had to stare at the screen and say, it's just one of those moments. Mm-hmm.
And there's a random, really crazy low shutter. Okay, and by the way, when we say low shutter, that's when it almost seems like we're going at the frames, there's like a lot more motion blur for anyone who doesn't know. Mm-hmm. And then a wide angle lens is when the center of the frame is less distorted, but the outer edges almost bend around it. So that's that visual style. But there's just a random fight scene like halfway through in a restaurant where someone gets like a name confused and then everyone starts trying to kill each other.
Yeah, and it is, you almost say, why did that happen? A lot of the time instead of, oh, I get that. That was a cool stylistic choice.
Absolutely.
And don't get me wrong. We don't want to sound like we're hating on this movie. We did like it.
Absolutely.
But
for sure.
There's just some parts of it that do confuse me. Mm-hmm. And I think we kind of have to talk about some of those confusing aspects. And like, Wong Kar-wai is not known to be the most like legible director. I guess he's known for his style. And he leans into it heavily with Fallen Angels. And I can see how someone would really appreciate it. Also, we didn't even really do a story breakdown, but at least
that's part of a
that's kind of part of the problem, but from what we were able to
discern,
yeah, we figured out that it was a film about two hitmen, or a hitman and a prostitute, who are working together, and then there's other characters that connect to their lives, and it's like a spider web, kind of similar to chunking and how all the characters
almost random kind of interactions too. And then the other main character is, like we said, mute. And his little shtick is that he goes into people's workplaces every night and
kind of lives there.
Yeah, lives their lives working, like chopping up their pork and whatnot.
Yeah.
I will say, this is a bit of a spoiler, so skip 10 seconds ahead. Mm-hmm. There's a camcorder motif that kind of, which is how they convey that the mute's dad dies. And I thought that was done very tastefully and well. And actually it was one of the best executions of it, mm-hmm. of a character death almost, in a movie that I saw. Like, because we almost saw it from the mute character's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a really kind of emotional way as he's going back through the videotapes, mm-hmm. and he's really experiencing his father's life.
Okay.
It was kind of beautiful.
Yeah, no, it was really interesting. Very intimate scene.
we both love to like a lot of the interpersonal stuff, a lot of the scenes. Some of the best parts of the movie were when the story almost took a backseat and let you just engross yourself in this very thematic art style that he was using. Absolutely. And then just kind of not turn your brain off, but let your brain just sink into the movie. Like what I mentioned with Yojimbo, when you can kind of visualize yourself in the world, immerse yourself, is when movies, I think, are done the best. And with Fallen Angels, one of course, the most iconic scene is the motorcycle. And at the ending with the motorcycle, it's just gorgeous visuals of the city and then just this very peaceful image of the two of them together on the motorcycle. Mm-hmm. That just really resonated with me, I think.
Absolutely.
Yeah, really impactful scene. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we really liked how it ended. We liked how it concluded. We liked a lot of things. This movie's pacing is actually really solid in my opinion.
I'd say so for sure. It I think something flew that by. Benefits it is you get fight scenes, which is almost rare for a Wong Kar-wai movie. And especially, and while we said the random one in the restaurant's a little insane,
yeah,
there are some where the hitman is in shootouts, and it's, we almost get the sense, like an existential sense, that maybe he wants to die, mm-hmm. because that's kind of what he's going through right now. And he's not exactly defending himself, but the fact that he just puts himself in the middle of all his enemies, it's and it makes for insane action, and that really keeps you in it if the story itself is almost slowing down.
And there's so many like love triangles and then just like different dynamics with all these characters. Mm-hmm. Little facts about these characters that you didn't know that just all tie into the story. And also, for a Chinese film, it feels a little more international than you'd expect.
Right.
When just some aspects, like the main in quotes, character, the mute guy, his mom is Russian, and they just kind of throw that in there.
Yeah.
And it's not really an important fact, but it is referenced, and it's just kind of interesting how much this movie does with just, I guess, immersing you in the world. But like we said, the story itself can be a little, can take a backseat sometimes. Yeah.
But with such a kind of jumbled and kind of thrown together almost the same story, I think thematically it's very strong. Like, yes. Most Wong Kar-wai movies, it's about love, mm-hmm. and about finding a partner, or at least finding consolation in someone else. And I think from that perspective, it does very well. Mm-hmm. It just struggles. Like, it gives you these kind of moments that really show you, that really have something, a lot to say about love and kind of relationships as a whole.
Yeah.
And I just kind of wish that the story stitched together around those themes better.
Mm-hmm. And well, obviously we're critiquing it a lot here. I think this film did a lot right. It's colored phenomenally. Like, insane. The greens and reds in this movie really just strike your eyes. But we both enjoyed this film. I think I can speak for both of us when I say that. And shall we give it our rating? Or first, let's talk about Wong Kar-wai and his relation to Chinese film first.
So when we were talking about this episode kind of beforehand, we were like, and what's really interesting about all these movies is that they're by the best director from each of these countries, or debatably the best.
Mm-hmm.
And Owen brought up a good point about Edward Yang, who's actually Taiwanese, I believe,
mm-hmm.
but could be considered the best director, is arguably the best director to come from the Chinese cinema landscape.
Yeah.
And so how would you argue Edward Yang?
Well, with Edward Yang, he's a bit of the toughest director for us to put the pin on necessarily. And because neither of us have really experienced Edward Yang's cinema.
Yeah, like Yi Yi,
Brighter Summer Day are his two major films that just everyone seems to be enamored with. They're both incredibly well-reviewed films. And, of course, Wong Kar-wai's got his three very well-reviewed films, all of which you've seen now.
Right. Chungking, Fallen Angels, and, of course, In the Mood for Love.
Yeah. But with Edward Yang and someone we don't really know the style of, besides having really long movies, like Brighter Summer Day is 4 hours, no joke. And
I mean, that's certainly a style, though, for sure.
It is certainly a style. And, you know, if we talk about Kobayashi, then, who also makes really long movies.
Really long movies.
Like 9 hours long and then splits it into three parts. But, no, it's like with Edward Yang, of course, it's a bit of a unique perspective. And I think, however, Wong Kar-wai and Edward Yang are known for different things.
Yeah.
Wong Kar-wai being his such an iconic style. Like, you just, you know when you're watching a Wong Kar-wai movie. Because it's going to look like a fucking Wong Kar-wai movie.
Yeah. And I think if we do an episode, both of us should watch Happy Together, mm-hmm. which is another Tony Leung film. Yeah. And I think there's another one. I'm trying to remember. But it's the one with the metaphor about the bird. I can't remember the name. I think it might be Days of Being Wild. Mm. But I'm not sure. And I just, seeing a few clips from those movies, I can just tell they might not be as highly lauded as the big three, but I think we might like them more,
mm-hmm.
just from a storytelling perspective.
Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to watch some more Bong Joon-ho. Oh my God. Holy Switching God. Over to the next part already. But Wong Kar-wai. And we'll give our little reviews of this movie real quick.
Yeah, let me check.
I like the style a lot, and I think to quote my earlier review of this movie, it is, I would say it's a bit of a style over substance film, but
sadly, yeah.
The symbolism and cinematography, top notch. I think I would give this either a 7 or a 7.5 out of 10. Both, I think, are valid rankings.
Very respectable.
Remember, 7 isn't a bad score, guys. This is in grade school. 7, yeah. Very good score.
Yeah, for me, it's a 7 on the dot. And I think just because I know the ceiling of Wong Kar-wai so well, that, especially from a storytelling standpoint, that's what Fallen Angels kind of fell short for me.
Mm-hmm.
But again, short by meaning 3 stars away from perfect.
Yeah.
So, pretty short.
To transition very smoothly to our next segment, let's hop back across the Pacific and a little down south to,
Your geography skills are amazing.
Well, it's like a little bit of the Pacific. It's
little bit. Yeah, go for it.
But whatever.
Keep talking.
These are just our charming personalities showing through in this podcast. But Korea, South Korea, where, you know, our good friend, not Bong Joon-ho, but his rival, friend, we don't really know the relation, Park Chan-wook. And I'm personally a massive fan.
Absolutely. This guy has not stopped talking about Decision to Leave.
Yes, which I'll talk about in a later episode. Decision to Leave, probably my favorite looking movie ever.
Mm-hmm.
So beautiful.
Which is a very kind of crazy standpoint from someone who's seen so many outstanding films.
I know.
Like, that's a... I'm hoping he's not exaggerating. But I also, at the same time, I trust his...
My judgment.
His judgment.
Yeah.
But anyway, so we are going to talk about Old Boy.
So,
yay.
If you don't want to be spoiled for Old Boy, yeah. If you don't want to be spoiled for Old Boy,
skip ahead for sure.
Skip ahead to late in the video.
Yeah, really do.
Like last 10 to 15 minutes of the video, maybe. Because
mm-hmm. there's a lot to unbox here. So, the first. The
longest segment.
The first half of the movie, and even watching it with, when I watched it the second time, I showed it to my two roommates,
mm-hmm.
Cash and Ben, who will both hopefully come on the podcast at some point.
Yeah.
When we kind of cut it off, because the first night we watched it, it was like 1 a.m, we watched the first 30 minutes, and they were like, Zach, we actually both really mess with this movie, but we were all so tired because we've been shooting for the past few weeks.
Yeah.
And so... We were obviously all very tired, and we were just going to finish it another night. So their perspectives on it, where it was like almost, like they said, it seemed like the Daredevil TV show, the Netflix one, took a lot of inspiration from it, which of course it did. And they also said it just felt somewhat like a more dramatic John Wick movie, like a classic revenge story, which watching it the first time, especially if you watch through the iconic hallway scene,
mm-hmm.
it definitely feels like John Wick, but with more thematically charged writing.
Yeah. Like, more well-written, more thematic.
Yeah, more to say about it.
John Wick. But, yeah, it feels a lot like John Wick at first, and you're like, I mean, I like this. This is really good action, but where's where's this like top something movie of all time that I'm expecting? Yeah,
and something that keeps you hooked before that little, before the ending is really what we think puts it in an amazing, like greatest movie of all time conversations. Mm-hmm. But until you can get to that point, what really keeps you hooked is the colors and the cinematography and, of course, the action. But yes. Another thing that went under the radar that when I watched it and that Cash kept bringing up was the quotability of this movie was amazing. Yeah. There were so many hard quotes like, even though I'm no better than a beast, do I not have the right to live? Or ooh, when you laugh, the world laughs with you. When you weep alone. Like, it might be a weird movie at some points, but it's insanely,
really weird at times.
Which we'll talk about soon, for sure.
Don't worry, we'll get around to that. But obviously the ending and the, if you haven't clicked off, I highly advise you to click off by now.
The plot twist, we'll say that for now.
Yeah, just the plot twist. I went into this movie knowing that there was a plot twist, but I had no idea what it was. Did you go in not knowing anything?
I knew for a fact there was a plot twist. Like, I'd always see, you know, on the Watch Mojo, I'd see the top plot list of all plot twists of all time. There were some movies like Shutter Island where I just didn't really care enough to skip through it. But Old Boy, the way they framed it before they actually like talked about what it was, I had to skip over those parts in the video. And I'm so glad I did, because seeing it, experiencing it, was insanity. Oh my
god, it was by far one of the coolest plot twists I've ever. Cool might not be the right word, but
one of the most insane and earth-shattering plot twists. But we'll get there.
We
should build to that point. So the beginning is done. So the problem that my roommates had with it was a little hard for them to follow, and that might be because since they're less experienced with Korean, Chinese, Japanese, really Asian cinema as a whole, East Asian, sorry, cinema as a whole, they sometimes struggle to tell characters apart, just based off dialogue, character traits, or really just how the movie was shot. Sometimes it would seem like some characters were the same people because it was almost like they were being treated the same way.
Yeah.
Like the hypnotist and then Mido were confused for a little bit, and I had to explain. Mm. But outside of that, I think the foreign language aspect also kind of harmed it a little bit, at least for my two American friends who viewed it. Mm-hmm. It made sense to me. I was able to follow it, but I can see where they got confused.
Yeah.
Because especially in the opening, when the main character, Oh Dae-soo, just disappears, it's a little bit, they were confused by that. But I think it gets more clear as you watch it. So in the beginning, we'll give a little plot overview.
Yeah.
Oh Dae-soo is human trafficked, sort of. And he is trapped in a room where he, for 15 years, where he pretty much goes insane.
Yes.
Anything you'd like to talk about what happens in
there? Obviously he experiences some hallucinations in the room, and then one day he's just out.
Yeah, so he's from like 9 years. So he's basically supposed to be in prison there for 15 years, and he tells us that in a voiceover, even though at the moment while you're watching it, he's still in the room. He, a few months before he's able to actually escape, he is hypnotized, or he meets a hypnotist, like she sent in to him, and then let out. But before then, before we get to there, we should talk about, there are a few interesting choices. There's a rather long masturbating sequence, and we're not sure that was done the most tastefully. There's a metaphor of the ants, which I thought was really cool. Yes. And he's basically swarmed by the ants, which crawl all over his face.
They come out of his skin, actually. Mm-hmm. Which, you know, if you ever heard people online talk about that, there are bugs inside your skin. That's the first thing I thought of when I saw that scene. And, of course, the giant random ant sitting on the train.
Which, happens a little bit later, but is extremely interesting, to say the least.
It throws people for a loop on their first view, for sure.
But anyway, he gets out, and he meets a man who, I guess that's not as important to the plot and should really just be something they encounter.
Yeah.
But anyway, so he gets out, and he kind of goes around. He meets this sushi chef, mm-hmm. Mido, who kind of helps him on his journey.
And well, after they meet, they go and they chase down this guy, who is our villain of the movie. And the way he's portrayed at first is it seems that he's not necessarily more physically powerful than Odesu.
He just happens to be smarter and wealthier. Mm-hmm. And really, I don't know about smarter, but he is just he has every advantage. Mm-hmm. And so Odesu spends the movie tracking him down and kind of overcoming these adversaries. There are some amazing fight scenes, including one of the best one takes of all time.
The hallway scene.
The hallway scene. You'll know when you see it. There's also some gratuitous torture. So yes. If there's any horror or like gore fans, you should still absolutely watch this movie because it is brutal. Mm-hmm. If you don't like going to the dentist, don't watch this movie. It's not for you.
Wouldn't recommend if that's the case. But, no,
absolutely not.
Yeah, and like we were saying, with it kind of takes him down a trip down memory lane, mm-hmm. so to speak, where he sees these various places from his past. And as it all slowly builds up into a crescendo, we get to the final place. He gets to it takes an elevator up to the villain's last floor. Well, first, let's prelude that with the fact that the chef he's been with becomes a slight love interest.
Right, absolutely. So he has to save her from some other, I guess you could say, goons, henchmen almost, that kind of come after her. It's implied they might have raped her, but they didn't, like, I don't think went as far as to, like, fully rape her, but they definitely sexually harassed her. Action. And so, certainly, they grow close together, and of course, there is in Park Chan-wook fashion, very long sex scene.
Which is very guttural.
You see everything.
But it is made to sound very, like, violent.
Yeah.
And
there's a line, she's like, it hurts, but I'm enduring it. And that's kind of...
The noises they make are very violent. They're animalistic. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Oh my God, that just shows how locked in we are. But, it is... It's like a scene where you're like, I kind of want to look away because of how just like...
Yeah, because it's like if it was just like a little 10-second sex scene, it'd just be like, okay. But you just keep on watching and watching. But then we see they kind of fall in love. Daisu he traps Mido in the same place he was trapped. I wouldn't say trapped, but he like puts her there so she can be protected. Mm-hmm. And then he goes to...
Finish the job.
Yeah, he goes to get his revenge against the antagonist who locked him up for 15 years.
Yes.
And that's when the world comes crashing down as Daisu
learns the truth behind his situation.
So, first off, messed up thing number one, we learn the reason that the antagonist is vengeful is because Daisu exposed him for having a sexual affair with his own sister. So not Daisu's sister, but the villain had sex with his own sister.
Incest.
Kind of messed up. I don't know if... Yep. To each his own. No, not to each his own. Not to each his own.
But it's...
not really
It's cool. One of those things where you see it and you're like, oh.
Yeah, okay. When I watched it the first time with Owen's roommate, Dylan, we were like, wait a minute. Is that supposed to be the bad guy? And then we realized, yeah, that's the bad guy eating out his own sister. And of course, because it's Park Chan-wook, you have to watch it.
Yep. And yeah, have fun doing that. Yeah. Because not only is that Lee Woo-jin's the villain's name, which I definitely didn't look up. But yes, he is a terrible villain. And then we learn... And even more.
Wait. First off, we also think it's important to note that while Daisu did expose them for, of course, having a sexual relationship, that started a rumor that Lee Woo-jin's sister, Lee Soo-ah, I believe her mm-hmm. name is, got pregnant. And so she didn't actually, almost in like a placebo way, Odai Su's rumors made Lee Sua think she was pregnant. So her stomach got physically bigger and she stopped having her period. Which, so basically, and there's actually a line where it wasn't Lee Woojin's dick that got his sister pregnant, but Odai Su's tongue.
Yeah, which sounds a lot freakier than it actually is. Yeah. But actually, no, it sounds the right amount of freak. It's
pretty freaky. Anyways, yeah. And then, so...
she kills herself.
Yeah, the sister kills herself, and Lee Woojin feels like Odai Su basically made her kill herself. Mm-hmm. And then...
is both his lover and his sister, which don't even think and about it.
Possibly the mother of his child.
Yeah. Fun. So, not only is that revealed, so you think that's the big bombshell, right? No, actually, the big bombshell is that because of that, that's the reason why he did all this to Odai Su. But that wasn't enough. The 15 years of torture, 15 years in hell, that was not enough. And guess what else happens? Odai Su was his love interest this whole time.
Mido.
Is his daughter.
Right. So, in the beginning, we established that the day Odai Su gets kidnapped is his daughter's birthday. Mm-hmm. And we know she's turning 3. So 15 years later, she's 18. And Lee Woojin, with all the hypnotist stuff that was going on, Lee Woojin hypnotized Odai Su and Mido separately so that they would kind of come together and almost beyond their own wills fall in love. And that brings a new context to the sex scene and all of the other...
why that was so painful to endure.
...stuff that we had to watch through this whole movie. We basically, Park Chan-wook forces the audience to watch a father and daughter have sex.
Yeah, which leaves quite possibly one of the worst tastes in your mouth you could ever have.
Right.
And it's just brutal. It puts Odai Su into shambles. He's at complete control of the villain.
And Lee, I think we shouldn't reveal anything else about the scene, because if anyone who still hasn't seen it, it definitely gets the sex with the daughter, the incest, and all of it definitely gets punctuated, but we'll leave it at that in case, because everyone should still watch this movie, for sure.
If you haven't clicked off, by the way, I don't know what you were doing with your life. Please just don't watch the movie for yourself, man.
But when you watch it, you're going to notice some things.
You can come back and finish the episode after you watched it.
Absolutely. And, so there's some other things that punctuate this twist and make it even more disgusting. But basically, by the time you're done with this movie, you feel, like, worse about humanity, worse about yourself, and worse about your parents, sisters, daughters, wherever you are when it comes to your familial status. You feel worse.
Yeah. So,
since Owen is 50% Vietnamese and 25% Indian, his daughters probably won't be his type.
Yeah. Well, anyways. And not only that, I'm probably not related to any girl I get with. Hopefully. always gotta include that, because never know when I'm gonna get hypnotized by a fucking...
We'll talk to you later. We'll talk to you later. Bye.
Anyways, back to what I was saying.
Because we've had to cut anyway. Back up, because when you laugh, you keep blowing up
the mic. I do keep blowing out the mic when I laugh.
Anyways. See, it's like, that's what you do. Anyways, action.
More nonchalant now. But, like I'm saying, Old Boy is a masterpiece. It is not a movie that makes you feel good about yourself. It's not like Despicable Me, for lack of a better example.
But it definitely makes you... So, like I said, I watched it with one of my roommates, Cash, and he had a really good point. He said, I thought it was a really good movie. I thought it was really good story, really well made, really well executed filmmaking, but he would never want to watch it again.
Which I can understand.
I personally, I think the filmmaking is way, way too incredible for me to
ignore. Yeah, to you ignore. Can't just move past it.
And yes, the story is fucked up, but the story is also phenomenal. Like, if you know about the history of Old Boy, it is based on a comic book, a Korean comic book, I believe, by the same name. It also might be a manga that it's based on, but I can't recall. Either way, it has its origins in comic books, which makes sense for the first half. Not really for the second half.
Not sure who is reading those books and what kind of porn they think they're into. whatever it is, it's interesting and everyone should watch Old Boy.
Now, I'll also address this in a little brief segment. This movie does have an American adaptation. So when you're going and looking for this movie,
don't watch that one. With Old Josh
Boy,
Brolin.
Yes. Old Boy came out in 2003. Old Boy did not come out in 2013. Little 10-year anniversary they gave it to a director who I really like and who I think everyone really likes, Spike Lee. But not his kind of movie to make. Nope. And you can kind of tell that by the fact that it's like a 1-star average on Letterboxd and pretty much every other medium known to man. Mm-hmm. Terribly reviewed. But that aside, Old Boy has been gaining a lot of traction recently due to its re-release in theaters, mm-hmm. and it's like very accessible nowadays. Weirdly, when I watched this, Zach got lucky here. They moved it to Netflix for you guys. You guys get the easy.
Right.
I had to buy this thing on disc. I could have just pirated it, but my dad wanted to watch it as well. And as you can see, maybe not wasn't the best choice to watch it with my dad.
Right. I would not recommend watching this with your parents or children.
Because I feel like it's just like one of those movies where you're like, that was really disturbing. I'm not sure they wanted to see that.
And it's almost like a bit of a curse. Like, after I saw it, my first thought was, who else can I screw over by making them watch this movie? Because it truly does affect you on a very personal and human level. Yeah. And it really just...
It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience for, like, hopefully everyone that's here has seen the movie. It is a life-changing movie, in my opinion. It's one of my favorites of all time. And saying favorites sounds a little weird, but it's just a masterpiece of a film. The cinematography, the editing, the choreography is all phenomenal. Storytelling, incredible. The acting. Acting is one of those things where you really have to be incredible at it to translate it through language. And this movie is just...
Right. We can't. Neither of us can speak
a lick of Korean, but
holy, the acting still shines through. Like, it's you don't miss a beat.
Yeah.
And so, speaking about the twist and kind of context of the rest of the movie, have you rewatched it?
I have rewatched it.
Were there any things you like noticed that other than like the obvious stuff that kind of foreshadowed this twist at the end?
I feel like almost every aspect of the movie kind of slowly hints towards the secret. Mm-hmm. And are there some specific things that you're thinking of right now?
Well, for me, in the scene where Daisu and Mido meet, this is like right after Daisu gets released from his kind of his little, like I would describe it, his little room of hell.
Yeah.
He's obviously very hungry after not eating pretty much anything for 15 years. He just ate fried dumplings once a day. He goes to a sushi place and meets Mido, and there he gets a phone call from Lee Woo-jin. Mm-hmm. And when Daisu asks, when he's on the phone and is like, I'm the guy, when Lee Woo-jin says, I'm the guy that puts you in jail, or something along those lines, Daisu goes, why? And in like a brief, literally probably like a seventh of a second, the camera cuts to Mido. And then it cuts back to Daisu, like, again, less than a second later, mm-hmm. to kind of show she is why the 15 years had to happen.
Yeah.
And it's great, a little subliminal messaging. Mm-hmm. And again, like Owen said, the rest of the movie also kind of builds around the twists at the end. But it's little things like that that I noticed that are just like, yeah, that's just totally his daughter.
Yeah, and it's one of those things where when I watched the movie for the first time, this Zach had a similar experience, and
We're at one point you think you know the twist.
Yeah, you think.
And I remember since I was watching Cyberpunk Edgerunners. Still haven't finished the show. Sorry. I hear great things though, and I enjoyed what I saw. But I remember we came out for a short, quick recess so I could grab some bread, which was the snack for the night because we didn't stock up beforehand. But I went out, and Zach and Dylan conversed with me, and I remember talking to them, and I was like, so how are y'all feeling about the movie? And Zach pulled me aside and was like, I think I figured it out. And well, I was so really ready because I was
with it. I was
no,
like,
he was a little shaky about it.
I was like, because I was like, there's no way this big twist is just this.
And but you're like, were they in the room the whole time?
Like, did he never?
And then you're like, tell me if I'm right. And I go, because I can't say, like, obviously I'm not gonna be like, no, because it's gonna help him figure out the twist. So I just had to kind of be like, and then he was like, oh, so I'm right. And I was like, I wouldn't go that far. I wouldn't say that. And as you know, if you can tell by watching this podcast or this movie, not quite there, but I actually had the same thought when I was watching the movie for the first time. I thought I had it. I thought I was locked in. I was like, oh, they better do this cool. They better make this cool because this is not that like cool a plot twist I expected. I had high expectations for this movie. And then
it better not just be he never left the room.
And then as Lee Woo-jin is revealing his big thing, you kind of start to put the pieces together.
I turned to Dylan.
And then
and I was like, oh my God, like, oh my God, it's his daughter. And this was like right before, this was like 2 minutes before the actual like reveal fully happened.
Uh-huh.
And then we're sitting there and the whole time we're both just, I can tell we're both thinking, if not like audibly saying, no, 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 no.
It can't be, right?
It can't be.
They wouldn't do that, right?
That's just not a plot line that's acceptable to do in a movie.
We're not in America anymore. America, there's kind of the guidelines of what you can and can't do.
Somewhat, yes.
Somewhat, in foreign films, they get pretty freaky. And, And Old Boy, I think, is probably one of the best examples of a movie that just is not afraid to show fucking everything. Like I said, absolute masterpiece. I remember Dylan, he was fucked up by the movie. That movie really got to him. But as he can attest to, when he comes on this podcast, and maybe we'll have a short callback. He called it a masterpiece, and I think there's no better word to describe a film like Old Boy. Its impact on film as a whole can definitely be seen, and I think it is not only one of the greatest villains in any movie, I think it's got one of the greatest plot twists in any movie.
Absolutely.
And a phenomenal ending as well. So many parts of this movie work well. And in the context of Korean cinema, this is probably the best Korean film I've seen. And I've obviously seen Parasite. Everyone and their mom should have seen Parasite by now. If you haven't seen Parasite, Eduardo Ku III, if you're listening, go watch Parasite, man. Fucking incredible movie. But actually, he won't even be listening to this part because he hasn't seen Old Boy. Awkward. But
Brick.
Old Boy is a great movie. And I know there's not everyone's going to get it on their first viewing because it's a fucking weird movie.
And actually, just to speak on that, I'd hate to interrupt, but my roommate Ben, he thought the whole time that the villain had used his own daughter. So Lee Woo-jin had a daughter with his sister and then made Dae-soo hook up with the incest baby. And he thought that was the twist. He was like, oh, okay, yeah, cool, that's fucked up. And then I think we were eating lunch the day after. And I was like, yeah. And he was like, wait, what? What about the daughters? And Cash and I kind of explained it to him. He's like, holy fuck, wait, what? And then it finally clicked. And Owen and I were super disappointed. We were like, oh, Ben's not really the most avid movie watcher. But
we love him, though.
Yeah, he's a great filmmaker. But
shout out Cry.
The fact that he, we were so sad that he missed out on like one of the greatest plot twists of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And just to see his face when it finally clicked for him, that made me so happy.
Yeah, because I remember hearing that night that he didn't really get it, and I was like, damn, I really thought he would like that one. I really thought he'd like, I don't want to say enjoy the movie, but appreciate
it's
the movie.
It's something that he is like not the most, like we said, he doesn't watch the most movies. It's something that we thought would like give him an aneurysm, like straight up
Yeah.
might kill him just because he's never been exposed to anything like that before. And I wish it really clicked for him in the moment. But as somebody who hasn't seen enough foreign films, it probably was harder for him not actually being able to audibly
follow.
Understand.
And let's not act like it's the most easy to follow a movie.
No, it's very surreal and kind of, again, definitely has confusing moments.
But if you want our full ratings of it, or let's first contextualize it against Bong Joon-ho. We kind of started on that, but...
Yeah, that's true. Well, first let's give our ratings of this movie, then we can...
Sure. So, I have this movie as one of my most highly rated films ever. I have this at the very high score of a 9.5 out of 10. I think this is a virtually near-perfect film. It's not quite at the 10 out of 10 level. That is a very, very exclusive club. But I'm a bit of a stickler when it comes to the 10 out of 10 club. I only have 5 films in there currently. But Old Boy, one of the greats, man.
Pretty damn close.
Pretty fucking close.
I have it at a 9, I think. Maybe a 9.5.
9 is also very valid, though.
Yeah, because it's just a movie, man. There's no way around it. It's just one hell of a film, and it leaves you, it impacts you so deeply. Like, there are films that make people cry, laugh, it makes you happy, make you sad. This movie just leaves you feeling disgusted.
It just, like, it leaves you like a corpse almost, like, just dead.
It's insane, and that's kind of the point of filmmaking, at least to both of us. I'll speak for myself, and I'm sure you
agree. No, I agree.
Films and art as a whole are meant to make people feel things.
Yeah.
And Old Boy definitely accomplishes that.
Mm-hmm. Like, one of my most proud accomplishments was hearing the other day that I made my screenwriting teacher, like, tear up when she read my script. Like, I was so proud of that because I made her feel something. And I don't even think it was that sad a script, but with Old Boy, it is a just profound film. And
with so much to say.
Exactly. And it just shows the worst of what humanity.
But yeah, so Old Boy just really, it shows you the worst of humanity. And that's important. It's important to make people think. Mm-hmm. And that's what Old Boy does so exceptionally well.
Yeah, I would have to agree. And in the context of Korean cinema as a whole, as someone who is, you know, I've indulged myself in half of Memories of Murder and all of Parasite. So Bong Joon-ho, as a director, I can speak on him a little bit. Oh, and I've also seen Snowpiercer, which might be important to mention.
But so when it comes to debating Park Chan-wook and Bong Joon-ho, I think it's very hard to pick one.
Mm-hmm. And once I've indulged their full filmographies, I can give you...
Yeah, once we've got more, we can...
Of course, they're not
a comprehensive
done as well
view. Yeah, they're still working, which is what's so amazing about having both of them in the industry.
Yeah.
I think you don't, at this point, even have to pick a favorite. Maybe in 20 years, we can look back and say, yeah, Bong Joon-ho did better. And I do think Bong Joon-ho, at this point, winning Best Picture with his film for... The first time out of any international film,
that's pretty
cool. That might make his career a little better at the moment just because he has such an accomplishment as a filmmaker from a country outside of America.
Absolutely. Like, he has the greatest accomplishment out of
it. Yeah, exactly. So that might put him over Park Chan-wook at the moment, but in retrospect, I'm sure we'll be able to see, hopefully in the future, which one can be considered the greatest Korean filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
But at the moment, I think we can just appreciate them both.
Pretty equal debate from what I've seen. Like I said, Old Boy's probably the best movie out of the two of them that I've seen, though Parasite is also really fucking good.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I love Snowpiercer. I think that's a solid movie. I think it's a really good movie, honestly. But I think Decision to Leave as well hits me a little harder. So, of course, like I said, I'll finish Memories of Murder and get back to you about that Bong Joon-ho thing. Because a lot of people actually consider Memories of Murder to be his best movie.
Which is interesting, especially because, like we said, Parasite's the first to win Best Picture. And I do think there have definitely been other movies. Of course there have been other movies that deserve that. Like, I think Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon probably deserved a Best Picture. And I'm pretty sure it got a nomination, but it definitely didn't win.
It lost to Gladiator, though.
Right.
Which, also, tough competition.
It's a very tough competition. But, that being said, I do think, of course, there are other international films that
like Seven Samurai probably deserved it over...
Probably. Whatever won in 1954.
Yeah.
55, whatever
it would
be
the 55 Oscars, I think.
Yeah.
54.
But, the fact that Parasite actually did it marks a change in the dynamic of historic cinema in general.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, to just contextualize all of this, Asian cinema as a whole is very influential, and I think to ignore it as a filmmaker is criminal.
Acknowledge that I think if you want to be a filmmaker, you know, one of the most important things is scope. Like, obviously you can have a style that you stick to, like Tarantino or Leone or Kurosawa, whatever, but you should see
others' work,
amazing movies and of all sorts to kind of help you determine where you fit in that puzzle.
Yeah.
And I think Asian cinema is just so
profound
and influential and underappreciated by American audiences that it just needs to be talked about more.
Yeah, and as young filmmakers, we have a lot to talk about when it comes to the role of cinema, and I think a lot of my biggest inspirations can come from East Asian cinema. Mm-hmm. Obviously, American cinema is the dominant cinema, and it's where I experience most films, but foreign films as a whole can be really important to experience for guys like us.
Yeah, and it's a new culture, and I think that, and it's like we said, films should make you feel things, it should make you think, and coming from different cultures, it's helped us think about things that maybe American movies don't really focus on. Yeah. And that's why I'm excited on a later episode. And that's why I'm excited on a later episode to have our friend Cash come on, because he is Indian, and he has seen one of his favorite movies is from Bollywood, and it is Three Idiots, and he's going to give us his perspective on Indian cinema, which is something neither Owen, even though he's Indian, and myself really have much exposure to. So we're both very excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Like, we haven't even seen RRR. We're like, really?
we're Indian movie virgins. So we're going to get, but don't worry, that will be remedied soon.
By Cash. Lock in Cash.
But so East Asian cinema, fantastic. And everyone should go watch the filmographies of Kurosawa, Miyazaki, Kobayashi, Bong Joon-ho, Park Chan-wook, Edward Yang, and Wong Kar-wai.
Yeah, that's a lot of names. You guys, if you are not well-versed in them, and of course we're going to get more well-versed in them, we all got homework to do. And
absolutely.
Do you think this is a good place to wrap?
Actually, I do want to talk a little bit first about the future.
Yeah.
So obviously, hopefully this gave you guys a pretty clear structure. We're going to do a little intro, and we are going to talk about 3 movies a week, like we said in the beginning. But we also want to talk, once we bring guests on, which we will have a guest next episode, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. They're going to, at this point in every episode, we're going to talk about what they're doing. Like, obviously, throughout, we're going to be getting their perspective on all these different movies in regards to their different niches. But we also want to let them, like we said, kind of plug their stuff. So if you're interested in what they're saying, you can go watch what they're doing. And also, just give us a little insight on what they're working on at the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm sure everyone here is always working on stuff. Like, I know me personally, if I'm not writing a script, I'm shooting a script. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not editing, even if I'm editing, I'm writing at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, when you're a filmmaker, I don't think you ever stop filmmaking. So it's going to be good to see, it's going to be really interesting to hear what everyone is doing next.
And when you're not making a film, you're always thinking about the next one. Right. So, really, no days off. But right.
So, Owen, because this is going to be one of the only episodes with just us two, Owen, what are you working on next?
Well, since my script that I briefly mentioned in this episode that I finished, it was a 10-pager that I wrote for my class here. We are at USC right now for a little summer course. We're young individuals.
Yeah, we're going to be applying to film colleges these next years. Yeah. But we did a almost 2-month summer program where we got college credit in filmmaking classes, and actually got to write and do plenty of other filmmaking.
It was the whole experience, the whole package. Absolutely. Really. And I'm just gonna, since I wrote my script already and it's 10 pages and I'm decently proud of it, I'm saying, why do I not just tweak it a little bit for back home and what's feasible for me? Because there are a few sequences which I think would be hard to film, but I'm going to do that. I'm gonna go back home and I'm going to shoot that film. By the way, yes, we're together for this episode, but this might be one of the few episodes we are together for.
Absolutely, physically speaking.
Physically speaking, we'll all be on the podcast at the same time.
But, right, but Owen is from Massachusetts, and yep. I am from Tennessee. So this is going to be one of the few times we actually make it together.
But hey,
for now.
Yeah, for now, and also we're in the same at least time zone, so it shouldn't be too bad.
I'm an hour before you.
We're almost the same time zone. I didn't know that, but now I do. But that's also fine. We're like an hour apart. Like I said, I'm just going to shoot my script when I get home. Might run out a higher quality camera than the okay Sony camera I'm working with back home, but know how it is.
Yeah, of course.
And, what are you doing next?
Well, I have to start working on some application films for, like we said, we're going to be applying for college. But before that, because we still have time, I think I'm going to make an experimental film about...
Oh, I heard about this one.
Like a ritual, almost, kind of.
Yeah, I did hear about
this one. This story is basically... I'm not sure how proud of this I am, but it's really just an exercise in cinematography and lighting a... Because we don't, as 17-year-olds, don't have the most access to, like, locations and actors and stuff like that. I'm going to try to go... Or budget, which is a big thing. I'm going to see what I can do with production design and cinematography to still make my filmmaking look professional. Mm-hmm. And mine is basically a ritual in which a very complicated and bloody sacrifice wherein a witch spends about a minute and a half of the movie, and then at the end, from her bubbling cauldron, kind of rises the perfect grilled cheese. And yeah, it's sort of an exercise. And then after that, my British literature teacher is one of the more creative writers and people I've ever met. And so I talk to him, and he's going to send me some short story ideas that he never fully developed, so I can work on a very important skill that I'm a little, as from a directing standpoint, a little inexperienced with, and that's directing someone else's script.
Yeah.
So for practice on that, I'm going to film some of his short story ideas and make them into cohesive movies.
Yeah, of course. And also, I just wanted to mention another thing on the way that kind of connected to the podcast, more just connected to me because it's a personal project, but I'm going to be in the works writing a very, very long video essay on Neon Genesis Evangelion. So I had to plug that a little bit beforehand.
Right.
I don't know when that's going to be done, but we're 8 or 9 pages into writing the script, and we're not even 2/3 of the way through. So yeah, that's going to be fun. Awesome.
And also, Owen and I, like we said, we're at USC.
Yeah.
And so we both made films of some sort, at least. And I know Owen was in different classes than me. I made 4 films. Owen shot
in his cinematography class. But only one, like, real cohesive
Like
thing.
A cohesive film. But I'm sure both of ours will be online shortly if you guys are interested in viewing our work. Some of them are good. Some of them are not so good. And we are able to acknowledge that. And we're here to learn.
And don't worry, we have more stuff in the works. So.
Yeah. We have, hopefully, the good stuff coming along the way. So I think that's it for this week, this episode.
That sounds good to me.
Hopefully y'all enjoyed it, and we'd love for you to tune in next time.
Oh, my God, we're locked in. Anyways.
Same time next week.
Yeah, same time next week. That's a great way to end it.